are scientifically impossible, historically unreliable, and culturally regressive. We looked at the first of these issues of science and the Bible in the previous chapter. Now we will look at the other two. We can't trust the Bible historically. It is widely believed that the Bible is a historically unreliable collection of legends. A highly publicized forum of scholars, the Jesus Seminar, has stated that no more than 20% of Jesus' sayings and actions in the Bible can be historically validated. How do we respond to this? It is beyond the range of this book to examine the historical accuracy of each part of the Bible. Instead, we will ask whether we can trust the Gospels, the New Testament accounts of Jesus' life, to be historically reliable. By this I mean the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that the Church recognized very early on as authentic and authoritative. It is often asserted that the New Testament Gospels were written so many years after the events happened that the writers' accounts of Jesus' life can't be trusted, that they are highly embellished if not wholly imagined. Many believe that the canonical Gospels were only four out of scores of other texts and that they were written to support the Church hierarchy's power, while the rest, including the so-called Gnostic Gospels, were suppressed. This belief has been given new plausibility in the popular imagination by the best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code. In this novel, the original Jesus is depicted as a great but clearly human teacher, who many years after his death was made into a resurrected god by church leaders who did so to gain status in the Roman Empire. However, there are several good reasons why the Gospel accounts should be considered historically reliable rather than legends. The canonical Gospels were written at the very most 40 to 60 years after Jesus' death. Paul's letters, written just 15 to 25 years after the death of Jesus, provide an outline of all the events of Jesus' life to be found in the Gospels: his miracles, claims, crucifixion, and resurrection. This means that the biblical accounts of Jesus' life were circulating within the lifetimes of hundreds who had been present at the events of his ministry. The Gospel author Luke claims that he got his account of Jesus' life from eyewitnesses who were still alive. In his landmark book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Richard Baucom marshals much historical evidence to demonstrate that at the time the Gospels were written, there were still numerous well-known living eyewitnesses to Jesus' teaching and life events. They had committed them to memory, and they had remained active in the public life of the churches throughout their lifetimes, serving as ongoing sources and guarantors of the truth of those accounts. Baucom also uses evidence within the Gospels themselves to show that the Gospel writers named their eyewitness sources within the text to assure readers of their account's authenticity. Mark, for example, says that the man who helped Jesus carry his cross to Calvary was the father of Alexander and Rufus. There is no reason for the author to include such names unless the readers know or could have access to them. Mark is saying, "Alexander and Rufus vouch for the truth of what I am telling you if you want to ask them." Paul also appeals to readers to check with living eyewitnesses if they want to establish the truth of what he is saying about the events of Jesus' life. In his letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15, Paul refers to a body of 500 eyewitnesses who saw the risen Christ at once. You can't write that in a document designed for public reading unless there really were surviving witnesses whose testimony agreed and who could confirm what the author said. All this decisively refutes the idea that the Gospels were anonymous, collective, evolving oral traditions. Instead, they were oral histories taken down from the mouths of the living eyewitnesses who preserved the words and deeds of Jesus in great detail. It is not only Christ's supporters who were still alive. Also still alive were many bystanders, officials, and opponents who had actually heard him teach, seen his actions, and watched him die. They would have been especially ready to challenge any accounts that were fabricated. For a highly altered, fictionalized account of an event to take hold in the public imagination, it is necessary that the eyewitnesses and their children and grandchildren all be long dead. They must be off the scene, so they cannot contradict or debunk the embellishments and falsehoods of the story. The Gospels were committed to writing far too soon for this to occur. It would have been impossible then for this new faith to spread as it did had Jesus never said or done the things mentioned in the Gospel accounts. Paul could confidently assert to government officials that the events of Jesus' life were public knowledge. These things were not done in a corner, he said to King Agrippa in Acts chapter 26. The people of Jerusalem had been there. They had been in the crowds that heard and watched Jesus. The New Testament documents could not say Jesus was crucified when thousands of people were still alive who knew whether he was or not. If there had not been appearances after his death, if there had not been an empty tomb, if he had not made these claims, and these public documents claim that they happened, Christianity would never have gotten off the ground. The hearers would have simply laughed at the accounts. The four canonical Gospels were also written much earlier than the so-called Gnostic Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas, the best known of the Gnostic documents, is a translation from the Syriac, and scholars have shown that the Syriac traditions in Thomas can be dated to 175 AD at the earliest, more than 100 years after the time that the canonical Gospels were in widespread use. Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker wrote that the Gnostic Gospels were so late that they no more challenged the basis of the Church's faith than the discovery of a document from the 19th century written in Ohio and defending King George would be a challenge to the basis of American democracy. The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, however, were recognized as authoritative eyewitness accounts almost immediately. And so we have Irenaeus of Lyons in 160 AD declaring that there were four and only four Gospels. The working theory of many people today is that the Gospels were written by the leaders of the early church to promote their policies, consolidate their power, and build their movement. That theory does not fit at all with what we actually find in the Gospels. If this popular view is correct, we would expect to see many places in the Gospels where Jesus takes sides in debates that were going on in the early church. That is how, it is reasoned, the Gospels were shaped by Christian leaders to support their party. However, we do not find this. We know, for example, that one of the great controversies in the earliest church was that some believed Gentile Christians should be required to be circumcised. In light of that great conflict, it is remarkable that nowhere in the Gospel accounts does Jesus say anything about circumcision. The most likely reason that Jesus is silent about circumcision is that the early church did not feel free to fabricate things and put words in Jesus' mouth that he didn't utter. Why would the leaders of the early Christian movement have made up the story of the crucifixion if it didn't happen? Any listener of the gospel in either Greek or Jewish culture would have automatically suspected that anyone who had been crucified was a criminal, whatever the speaker said to the contrary. Why would any Christian make up the account of Jesus asking God in the Garden of Gethsemane if he could get out of his mission? Or why ever make up the part on the cross when Jesus cries out that God had abandoned him? These things would have only offended or deeply confused first century prospective converts. They would have concluded that Jesus was weak and failing his God. Why invent women as the first eyewitnesses of the resurrection in a society where women were assigned such low status that their testimony was not admissible evidence in court? It would have made far more sense, if you were inventing the tale, to have male pillars of the community present as witnesses when Jesus came out of the tomb. The only plausible reason that all these incidents would be included in these accounts is that they actually happened. Also, why constantly depict the apostles, the eventual leaders of the early church, as petty and jealous, almost impossibly slow-witted, and in the end as cowards who either actively or passively failed their master? Richard Baucom makes similar arguments about the depiction of Peter's denial of Jesus, even to the point of his calling down a curse on his master. Why would anyone in the early church want to play up the terrible failures of their most prominent leader? No one would have made such a story up. And even though it is true, Baucom reasons that no one but Peter himself would have dared to recount it, unless Peter himself was the source of it and had authorized its preservation and propagation. The literary form of the Gospels is too detailed to be legend. C.S. Lewis was a world-class literary critic. When reading the Gospels, he noted, "I have been reading poems, romances, vision, literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they are like. I know none of them are like this. Of this Gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. Lewis meant that ancient fiction was nothing like modern fiction. Modern fiction is realistic. It contains details and dialogue and reads like an eyewitness account. This genre of fiction, however, only developed within the last 300 years. In ancient times, romances, epics, or legends were high and remote. Details were spare and only included if they promoted character development or drove the plot. That is why, if you are reading Beowulf or the Iliad, you don't see characters noticing the rain or falling asleep with a sigh. In modern novels, details are added to create the aura of realism, but that was never the case in ancient fiction. The gospel accounts are not fiction. In Mark chapter 4, we are told that Jesus was asleep on a cushion in the stern of a boat. In John chapter 21, we are told that Peter was 100 yards out in the water when he saw Jesus on the beach. He then jumped out of the boat, and together they caught 153 fish. In John chapter 8, as Jesus listened to the men who caught a woman in adultery, we are told he doodled with his finger in the dust. We are never told what he was writing or why he did it. None of these details are relevant to the plot or character development at all. If you or I were making up an exciting story about Jesus, we would include such remarks just to fill out the story's air of realism. That assumes the existence of a genre that was unknown in the first century. The only explanation for why an ancient writer would mention the cushion, the 153 fish, and the doodling in the dust is because the details had been retained in the eyewitness's memory. Richard Baucom has compiled a great deal of research by psychologists on the marks of recollective memory. He looks at the marks of eyewitness accounts of events and how they differ from speculative or fictional accounts or of composite historical reconstructions. Recollective memory is selective. It fixes on unique and consequential events. It retains irrelevant detail, as Lewis observes. It takes the limited vantage point of a participant rather than that of an omniscient narrator. And it shows signs of frequent rehearsal. Baucom then shows these same marks in the gospel narratives. Vivid and important events can stay with you for decades if frequently rehearsed and or retold. Factor in the fact that disciples in the ancient world were expected to memorize master's teachings, and that many of Jesus' statements are presented in a form that was actually designed for memorization, and you have every reason to trust the accounts. Baucom also looks to anthropology for evidence that the gospel writers did not feel free to embellish or fabricate words or events in the life of Jesus. Critical scholars from earlier in the 20th century assumed the early Christians would have used a relatively fluid process for transmitting popular folktales, and that they would have felt free to change the tales from the past in order to correspond to their present realities and situation. Baucom, however, cites Jan van Sina's study of oral traditions in primitive African cultures, in which fictional legends and historical accounts are clearly distinguished from each other, and much greater care is taken to preserve historical accounts accurately. This finding undermines 100 years of critical gospel scholarship. Baucom writes, "Gospel scholars, from the form critics onward, believed that early Christians in the transmission of Jesus traditions would not have made any distinction between the past time of the history of Jesus and their own present, because oral societies do not make such distinctions. This is untrue." As I write today, there seems to be a flood of what David Van Bima of Time magazine calls biblical revisionism, following in the footsteps of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code. He refers to the recent claim that Jesus' tomb has been found, and that he married Mary Magdalene and had children. Other scholars have published books claiming similar new insights from the Gnostic Gospels. More seem sure to come. Van Bima quotes Publishers Weekly senior religion editor Lynn Garrett, who speaks of what she calls the Da Vinci Code effect. "Speculative histories were out there before Dan Brown wrote," says Garrett, "but they didn't make the bestseller lists, and their authors didn't go on The Daily Show." All these revisionist histories completely ignore the growing body of careful scholarship that shows there was a very large number of eyewitnesses to Jesus' life who lived on for years. As British scholar Vincent Taylor famously remarked, "If the skeptics about the Bible are right, the disciples must have been translated into heaven immediately after the resurrection." That is the only way that legendary elements could have come into the story of Jesus by the time the Gospels were written. But that couldn't have happened. So ironically, as the popular media is promoting accounts of Jesus' life based on the highly skeptical biblical scholarship that rose a century ago, the actual foundations of that scholarship is eroding fast. If we let our unexamined beliefs undermine our confidence in the Bible, the cost may be greater than we think. If you don't trust the Bible enough to let it challenge and correct your thinking, how could you ever have a personal relationship with God? In any truly personal relationship, the other person has to be able to contradict you. For example, if a wife is not allowed to contradict her husband, they won't have an intimate relationship. Remember the two movies, The Stepford Wives? The husbands of Stepford, Connecticut decide to have their wives turned into robots who never cross the wills of their husbands. Stepford wife was wonderfully compliant and beautiful, but no one would describe such a marriage as intimate or personal. Now, what happens if you eliminate anything from the Bible that offends your sensibility and crosses your will? If you pick and choose what you want to believe and reject the rest, how will you ever have a God who can contradict you? You won't. You'll have a Stepford God, a God essentially of your own making, and not a God with whom you can have a relationship and genuine interaction. Only if your God can say things that outrage you and make you struggle, as in a real friendship or marriage, will you know that you have gotten hold of a real God and not a figment of your imagination. So an authoritative Bible is not the enemy of a personal relationship with God. It is the precondition for it. Part 2, The Grounds for Faith. Chapter 8, The Clues of God. How can we believe in Christianity if we don't even know whether God exists? Though there cannot be irrefutable proof for the existence of God, many people have found strong clues for his reality, divine fingerprints, in many places. I once met regularly with a brilliant young scientist who was haunted by a general sense that God existed. Much of what I am writing in this chapter and the next, I discovered during my conversations with him. He looked at one argument for God after another, and though many of them had a great deal of merit, he found that ultimately every one of them was rationally avoidable at some point. This troubled him greatly. "I can't believe unless I find at least one absolutely airtight proof for God," he said to me. I pointed out to him that he was assuming strong rationalism, and he got some relief when together we realized that he had no airtight proof for that. Then we began to go back and review the lines of reasoning that he had been calling proofs, and began to look at them instead as clues. When we went about it with that perspective, he began to see that, cumulatively, the clues of God had a lot of force to them. The philosopher Alvin Plantinga believes that there are no proofs of God that will convince all rational persons. However, he believes that there are at least two or three dozen very good arguments for the existence of God. Most readers who take the time to think through Plantinga's list will find some items compelling and others not. However, the accumulated weight of the ones you find appealing can be very formidable. I will trace out just a handful of them. The mysterious bang. Those of a more rational mindset have always been fascinated by the question, why is there something rather than nothing? This question has become even more interesting to people in the wake of the Big Bang theory. There's evidence that the universe is expanding explosively and outwardly from a single point. Stephen Hawking wrote, "Almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang." Scientist Francis Collins puts this clue in layman's language in his book, The Language of God. He writes, "We have this very solid conclusion that the universe had an origin, the Big Bang. 15 billion years ago, the universe began with an unimaginably bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. That implies that before that, there was nothing. I can't imagine how nature, in this case the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And it seems to me that had to be outside of nature." Everything we know in this world is contingent. has a cause outside of itself. Therefore, the universe, which is just a huge pile of such contingent entities, would itself have to be dependent on some cause outside of itself. Something had to make the Big Bang happen, but what? What could that be but something outside of nature, a supernatural, non-contingent being that exists from itself? Sam Harris, in his review of Francis Collins' book, makes the classic objection to this line of reasoning. In any case, he writes, even if we accepted that our universe simply had to be created by an intelligent being, this would not suggest that this being is the God of the Bible. That is perfectly right. If we are looking at this as an argument proving the existence of a personal God, it doesn't get us all the way there. However, if we are looking for a clue that there is something besides the natural world, it is very provocative for many people. The cosmic welcome mat. For organic life to exist, the fundamental regularities and constants of physics, the speed of light, the gravitational constant, the strength of the weak and strong nuclear forces, must all have values that together fall into an extremely narrow range. The probability of this perfect calibration happening by chance is so tiny as to be statistically negligible. Some have said that it is as if there were a large number of dials that all had to be tuned to within extremely narrow limits, and they were. It seems extremely unlikely that this would happen by chance. Stephen Hawking concludes, "The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications." Elsewhere, he says, "It would be very difficult to explain why the universe would have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us." This has been called the fine-tuning argument or the anthropic principle, namely, that the universe was prepared for human beings. As an argument, it must be a pretty powerful one, because there is a lot of fierce rebuttals being published about it. The most common rejoinder, which Richard Dawkins makes in his book, The God Delusion, is that there may be trillions of universes. Given the enormous number of universes existing over enormous amounts of time and space, it is inevitable that some of them are fine-tuned to sustain our kind of life. The one we are in is one, so here we are. Again, as a proof, the fine-tuning argument is rationally avoidable. Though there's not a shred of proof that there are many universes, there's also no way to prove that there aren't. That means that, yes, it is possible that we just happen to find ourselves in the one out of a trillion universes in which life just happens. This is not inescapable proof that God exists. However, as a clue, this line of thinking has force. Alvin Plantinga gives this illustration. He imagines a man dealing himself 20 straight hands of four aces in the same game of poker. As his companions reach for their six shooters, the poker player says, "I know it looks suspicious, but what if there is an infinite succession of universes so that for any possible distribution of poker hands, there is one universe in which this possibility is realized? We just happen to find ourselves in one where I always deal myself four aces without cheating." This argument will have no effect on the other poker players. It is technically possible that the man just happened to deal himself 20 straight hands of four aces. Though you could not prove he had cheated, it would be unreasonable to conclude that he hadn't. It is technically possible that we just happened to be in the one universe in which organic life occurred. Though you could not prove that the fine-tuning of the universe was due to some sort of design, it would be unreasonable to draw the conclusion that it wasn't. While organic life could have just happened without a creator, does it make sense to live as if that infinitely remote chance is true? The regularity of nature. There is something about nature that is much more striking and inexplicable than its design. All scientific inductive reasoning is based on the assumption of the regularity, that is, the laws of nature, that water will boil tomorrow under the identical conditions of today. The method of induction requires generalizing from observed cases to all cases of the same kind. Without inductive reasoning, we couldn't learn from experience, we couldn't use language, we couldn't rely on our memories. Most people find that normal and untroubling, but not philosophers. David Hume and Bertrand Russell, as good secular men, were troubled by the fact that we haven't got the slightest idea of why nature regularity is happening now, and moreover, we haven't the slightest rational justification for assuming it will continue tomorrow. If someone would say, "Well, the future has always been like the past in the past," Hume and Russell reply that you are assuming the very thing you are trying to establish. To put it another way, science cannot prove the continued regularity of nature. It can only take it on faith. There have been many scholars in the last decades who have argued that modern science arose in its most sustained form out of Christian civilization because of its belief in an all-powerful personal God who created and sustains an orderly universe. As proof for the existence of God, the regularity of nature is escapable. You can always say, "We don't know why things are as they are." As a clue for God, however, it is helpful. The clue of beauty. Arthur C. Danto, the art critic at The Nation, once described a work of art that gave him a sense of what he called obscure but inescapable meaning. In other words, while great art does not hit you over the head with a simple message, it always gives you a sense that life is not a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. It fills you with hope and gives you the strength to carry on, though you cannot define what it is that moves you. Leonard Bernstein once rhapsodized about the effect of Beethoven on him. He wrote, "Beethoven turned out pieces of breathtaking rightness." Rightness, that's the word. When you get the feeling that whatever note succeeds the last is the only possible note that can rightly happen at that instant, in that context, then chances are you're listening to Beethoven. Melodies, fugues, rhythms, leave them to the Tchaikovskys and Hindemiths and Ravels. Our boy has the real goods, the stuff from heaven, the power to make you feel at the finish something is right in the world. There is something that checks throughout, that follows its own law consistently, something we can trust that will never let us down. If there is no God and everything in this world is the product of, as Bertrand Russell famously put it, an accidental collocation of atoms, then there is no actual purpose for which we were made. We are accidents. If we are the product of accidental natural forces, then what we call beauty is nothing but a neurologically hardwired response to particular data. You only find certain scenery to be beautiful because you had ancestors who knew you would find food there, and they survived because of that neurological feature, and now we have it too. In the same way, though music feels significant, that significance is an illusion. Love, too, must be seen in this light. If we are the result of blind natural forces, then what we call love is simply a biochemical response inherited from ancestors who survived because this trait helped them survive. Bernstein and Danto are testifying to the fact that even though we as secular people believe that beauty and love are just biochemical responses, in the presence of great art and beauty, we inescapably feel that there is real meaning in life. There is truth and justice that will never let us down, and love means everything. So what? Someone might object. Just because we feel something is true doesn't make it so. Are we, however, only talking about feelings here? What is evoked in these experiences is, more accurately, appetite or desire. Goethe refers to this as selige Sehnsucht, blessed longing. We not only feel the reality, but also the absence of what we long for. St. Augustine, in his Confessions, reasoned that these unfulfillable desires are clues to the reality of God. How so? Indeed, as it was just objected, just because we feel the desire for a steak dinner doesn't mean we will get it. However, while hunger doesn't prove that the particular meal desired will be procured, doesn't the appetite for food in us mean that food exists? Isn't it true that innate desires correspond to real objects that can satisfy them, such as sexual desire, corresponding to sex, physical appetite, corresponding to food, tiredness, corresponding to sleep, and relational desires, corresponding to friendship? Doesn't the unfulfillable longing evoked by beauty qualify as an innate desire? We have a longing for joy, love, and beauty that no amount or quality of food, sex, friendship, or success can satisfy. We want something that nothing in this world can fulfill. Isn't that at least a clue that this something that we want exists? This unfulfillable longing, then, qualifies as a deep, innate human desire, and that makes it a major clue that God is there. In our culture, there is a very influential school of thought that claims to have the answers to all these so-called clues. This is the school of evolutionary biology that claims everything about us can be explained as a function of natural selection. A book that seeks to explain all clues about God in this way is Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon by Daniel Dennett. Dennett claims that if we have religious feelings, it is only because those traits once helped certain people survive their environment in greater numbers and therefore pass that genetic code on to us. He sums up this view when he writes, "Everything we value, from sugar and sex and money to music and love and religion, we value for reasons. Lying behind and distinct from our reasons are evolutionary reasons, free-floating rationales that have been endorsed by natural selection." In the New York Times Magazine, Robin Morantz Hennig surveyed what evolutionists think about religion in an article entitled, "Why Do We Believe? How Evolutionary Science Explains Faith in God." She wrote, "We know that the idea of an infallible God is comfortable and familiar, something children readily accept. Why? Some evolutionists, such as David Sloan Wilson, think belief in God made people happier and more unselfish, which meant their families and tribes survived and they got better mates. Others, such as Scott Atran and Richard Dawkins, posit that belief in God is an accidental byproduct of other traits that did give adaptive advantage. Our ancestors who survived were most prone to detect agents in the brush, even when they weren't there, and who were most likely to impose narratives, causal reasoning, on everything that happened around them. However, these same traits make us more likely to believe in God, to see agents and narratives and intelligences where they don't actually exist." Despite fierce debates within the field, evolutionary theorists all agree that our capacity to believe in God is hardwired into our physiology because it was directly or indirectly associated with traits that helped our ancestors adapt to their environment. That's why arguments for God appeal to so many of us. That's all there is to it. The clues are clues to nothing. I think that ultimately the supposed clue killer ends up showing us one more clue for God to put beside the others. The first clue is the very existence of the world, the Big Bang. The secular person rightly responds, "But that doesn't prove God exists. Maybe the Big Bang just caused itself." The second clue is the fine-tuning of the universe, the one in a trillion-trillion chance that our universe supports organic and human life. Again, the secular person can very fairly respond, "But that doesn't prove God. It could be through sheer random circumstance that this universe is the one that was formed." Another clue is the regularity of nature. All scientific inductive reasoning is based on the assumption of this, though we haven't the slightest rational justification for assuming it will continue. When believers have responded that this is a clue to God's existence, non-believers retort rightly, "We don't know why nature is regular, it just is. That doesn't prove God." Another clue is the clue of beauty and meaning. If we are the product of the meaningless, accidental forces of nature, believers ask, how do you account for the sense we have that beauty matters, that love and life are significant? The secular person responds, "This doesn't prove God. We can explain all such senses and convictions through evolutionary biology. Our religious aesthetic and moral intuitions are there only because they helped our ancestors survive." However, as many thinkers point out, if this argument proves anything at all, it proves too much. If we can't trust our belief-forming faculties in one area, we should not trust them in any area. If there is no God, we should not trust our cognitive faculties at all. Oh, but we do, and that's the final clue. If we believe God exists, then our view of the universe gives us a basis for believing that cognitive faculties work, since God could make us able to form true beliefs and knowledge. If we believe in God, then the Big Bang is not mysterious, nor the fine-tuning of the universe, nor the regularities of nature. All the things that we see make perfect sense. Also, if God exists, our intuitions about the meaningfulness of beauty and love are to be expected. If you don't believe in God, not only are all these things profoundly inexplicable, but your view that there is no God would lead you not to expect them. Though you have little reason to believe your rational faculties work, you go on using them. You have no basis for believing that nature will go on regularly, but you continue to use inductive reasoning and language. You have no good reason to trust your senses that love and beauty matter, but you keep on doing it. Of course, none of the clues we have been looking for actually proves God. Every one of them is rationally avoidable. However, their cumulative effect is, I think, provocative and potent. Though the secular view of the world is rationally possible, it doesn't make as much sense of these things as the view that God exists. That's why we call them clues. The theory that there is a God who made the world accounts for the evidence we see better than the theory that there is no God. Those who argue against the existence of God go right on using induction language and their cognitive faculties, all of which make far more sense in a universe in which a God has created and supports them all by his power. I can imagine someone saying at this point, "So it's all inconclusive. All you are saying is that, on the whole, God probably exists, but nobody can make an airtight case. That means no one can know if there's a God or not." I don't agree. In the next chapter, I want to do something very personal. I don't want to argue why God may exist. I want to demonstrate that you already know that God does exist. I'd like to convince the reader that whatever you may profess intellectually, belief in God is an unavoidable basic belief that we cannot prove but can't not know. We know God is there. That is why even when we believe with all our minds that life is meaningless, we simply can't live that way. We know better. Chapter 9, The Knowledge of God. Conservative writers and speakers are constantly complaining that the young people of our culture are relativistic and amoral. As a pastor in Manhattan, I have been neck-deep in sophisticated 20-somethings for almost 2 decades, and I have not found this to be the case. The secular young adults I have known have a very finely honed sense of right and wrong. There are many things happening in the world that evoke their moral outrage. There is a problem with their moral outlook, however. In many cases, I have to put on my philosophy professor hat in order to be a good pastor to people. A young couple once came to me for some spiritual direction. They didn't believe in much of anything, they said. How could they begin to figure out if there even was a God? I asked them to tell me about something they felt was really, really wrong. The woman immediately spoke out against practices that marginalized women. I said I agreed with her fully since I was a Christian who believed God made all human beings, but I was curious why she thought it was wrong. She responded, "Women are human beings and human beings have rights. It is wrong to trample on someone's rights." I asked her how she knew that. Puzzled, she said, "Everyone knows it is wrong to violate the rights of someone." I said, "Most people in the world don't know that. They don't have a Western view of human rights. Imagine if someone said to you, 'Everyone knows that women are inferior.' You'd say, 'That's not an argument, that's just an assertion,' and you'd be right. So let's start again. If there is no God, as you believe, and everyone has just evolved from animals, why would it be wrong to trample on someone's rights?" Her husband responded, "Yes, it is true we are just bigger-brained animals, but I'd say animals have rights too. You shouldn't trample on their rights either." I asked whether he held animals guilty for violating the rights of other animals if the stronger ones ate the weaker ones. "No, I couldn't do that." "So he only held human beings guilty if they trampled on the weak?" "Yes," he said. "Why this double standard?" I asked. "Why did the couple insist that human beings had to be different from animals so that they were not allowed to act as was natural to the rest of the animal world? Why did the couple keep insisting that humans had this great, unique individual dignity and worth? Why did they believe in human rights?" "I don't know," the woman said. "I guess they are just there, that's all." The conversation was much more congenial than this very compressed account conveys. The young couple laughed at the weakness of some of their responses, which showed me that they were open to exploration, and that encouraged me to be more pointed than I ordinarily would have been. However, this conversation reveals how our culture differs from all the others that have gone before. People still have strong moral convictions, but unlike people in other times and places, they don't have any visible basis for why they find some things to be evil and other things good. It's almost like their moral intuitions are free-floating in midair, far off the ground. Polish poet Czesław Miłosz spoke of this. He wrote, "What has been surprising in the post-Cold War period are those beautiful and deeply moving words pronounced with veneration in places like Prague and Warsaw. Words which pertain to the old repertoire of the rights of man and the dignity of the person. I wonder at this phenomenon because maybe underneath there is an abyss. After all, those ideas had their foundation in religion, and I am not over-optimistic about the survival of religion in a scientific technological civilization. Notions that seemed buried forever have suddenly been resurrected, but how long can they stay afloat if the bottom is taken out? I don't believe Miwosh is right. I think that people will definitely go on holding to their beliefs in human dignity, even when conscious belief in God is gone. Why is this the case? I have a radical thesis. I think people in our culture know unavoidably that there is a God, but they are repressing what they know. It is common to hear people say no one should impose their moral views on others because everyone has the right to find truth inside him or herself. This belief leaves the speaker open to a series of very uncomfortable questions. Aren't there people in the world who are doing things you believe are wrong? Things that they should stop doing no matter what they personally believe about the correctness of their behavior? If you do, and everyone does, doesn't that mean you do believe there is some kind of moral standard that people should abide by regardless of their individual convictions? This raises a question. Why is it impossible in practice for anyone to be a consistent moral relativist even when they claim that they are? The answer is that we all have a pervasive, powerful, and unavoidable belief not only in moral values but also in moral obligation. All human beings have moral feelings. We call it a conscience. When considering doing something that we feel would be wrong, we tend to refrain. Our moral sense does not stop there, however. We also believe that there are standards that exist apart from us by which we evaluate our moral feelings. Moral obligation is a belief that some things ought not to be done, regardless of how a person feels about them within herself, regardless of what the rest of her community and culture says, and regardless of whether it is in her self-interest or not. The young couple had no doubts that people in other cultures should honor women's rights, for example. Though we have been taught that all moral values are relative to individuals and cultures, we can't live like that. In actual practice, we inevitably treat some principles as absolute standards by which we judge the behavior of those who don't share our values. What gives us the right to do that if all moral beliefs are relative? Nothing gives us the right. Yet, we can't stop it. People who laugh at the claim that there is a transcendent moral order do not think that racial genocide is just impractical or self-defeating, but that it is wrong. The Nazis who exterminated Jews may have claimed that they didn't feel it was immoral at all. We don't care. We don't care if they sincerely felt that they were doing a service to humanity. They ought not to have done it. We do not only have moral feelings, but we also have an ineradicable belief that moral standards exist outside of us by which our internal moral feelings are evaluated. Why? Why do we think those moral standards exist? A common answer today comes from what I called in the last chapter the clue killer, sociobiology or evolutionary psychology. This view holds that altruistic people, those who act unselfishly and cooperatively, survived in greater numbers than those who were selfish and cruel. Therefore, altruistic genes were passed down to us, and now the great majority of us feel that unselfish behavior is right. There are, however, many flaws in this theory, and it has been given some devastating critiques. An individual's self-sacrificing altruistic behavior toward his or her blood kin might result in a greater survival rate for the individual's family or extended clan, and therefore result in a greater number of descendants with that person's genetic material. For the evolutionary to have weight, however, the opposite response, hostility to all people outside one's group, should be just as widely considered moral and right behavior. Yet today we believe that sacrificing time, money, emotion, and even life, especially for someone not of our kind or tribe, is right. If we see a total stranger fall in the river, we jump in after him, or feel guilty for not doing so. In fact, most people will feel the obligation to do so even if the person in the water is an enemy. How could that trait have come down by a process of natural selection? Such people would have been less likely to survive and pass on their genes. On the basis of strict evolutionary naturalism, that is, the belief that everything about us is here because of a process of natural selection, that kind of altruism should have died out in the human race long ago. Instead, it is stronger than ever. Other arguments to demonstrate the reproductive benefits of altruism have also run into trouble. Some contend that altruistic behavior brings many indirect reciprocal benefits to the practitioner from others, but this can't account for our motivation to practice such acts when no one knows about them. Others have contended that sacrificial behavior benefits an entire group or society, enabling the entire society to pass on its genetic code. However, there is almost universal consensus that natural selection works on individuals, not whole populations. Evolution, therefore, cannot account for the origin of our moral feelings, let alone for the fact that we all believe there are external moral standards by which moral feelings are evaluated. This sense of moral obligation creates a problem for those with a secular understanding of the world. Carolyn Fluer-Lauben is an anthropologist whose professional field is dominated by what she called cultural relativism, a view that all moral beliefs are culturally created, that is, we believe them because we are part of a community that gives them plausibility, and that there is no basis for objectively judging one culture's morality to be better than another. Yet she was appalled by practices in societies she was studying that oppressed women. She decided that she should promote women's interests in the societies where she worked as an anthropologist. This immediately created a conundrum for her. She knew that her belief in women's equality was rooted in a socially located, that is, Northern European 18th century, individualistic mode of thought. What right did she have to promote her views over those of the non-Western societies where she worked? This is her response. She wrote, "Anthropologists continue to express strong support for cultural relativism. One of the most contentious issues arises from the fundamental question, what authority do we Westerners have to impose our own concept of universal rights on the rest of humanity? But the cultural relativist argument is often used by repressive governments to deflect international criticism of their abuse of their citizens. I believe that we should not let the concept of relativism stop us from using national and international forums to examine ways to protect the lives and dignity of people in every culture. When there is a choice between defending human rights and defending cultural relativism, anthropologists should choose to protect and promote human rights. We cannot just be bystanders." The author poses a difficult question. If all cultures are relative, then so is the idea of universal human rights. So how can I decide to impose my values on this culture? She has just said that her charge of oppression is based on a Western concept of individual freedom, but she has no answer for this conundrum. She simply declares that women are being oppressed, and she feels she has to stop it. We have to bring our Western values to these other nations. Our values are better than theirs, period. Fluer-Lauben is struggling with a major crisis in the field of human rights. Jürgen Habermas has written that, despite their European origins, human rights in Asia, Africa, and South America now constitute the only language in which the opponents and victims of murderous regimes and civil wars can raise their voices against violence, repression, and persecution. This reveals the enormous importance of the morality of human rights, which Michael J. Perry defines as the twofold conviction that every human being has inherent dignity and that it is obligatory that we order our lives in accordance with this fact. It is wrong to violate the equal dignity of other human beings, but why should we believe that? On what does this dignity depend? Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, in his essay, Where Do Rights Come From?, lays out the possibilities. Some say human rights come from God. If we were all created in God's image, then every human being would be sacred and inviolable. Dershowitz rejects this answer, since so many millions of people are agnostic. Others say human rights come from nature, or what has been called natural law. They argue that nature and human nature, if it is examined, will reveal that some kinds of behavior are fitting with the way things are and are right. However, Dershowitz points out that nature thrives on violence and predation, on the survival of the fittest. There is no way to derive the concept of the dignity of every individual from the way things really work in nature. Another theory claims that human rights are created by us, the people who write the laws. Many argue that it is in the interests of societies to create human rights, because honoring individual dignity means that in the long run, everyone in the community is better off. However, what if a majority decides it is not in their interest to grant human rights? If rights are nothing but a majority creation, then there is nothing to appeal to when they are legislated out of existence. Dershowitz, quoting Ronald Dworkin, argues that this third view of human rights is inadequate. Dworkin writes, "It is no answer to say that if individuals have these rights, then the community is better off in the long run. because when we say someone has the right to speak his mind freely, we mean he is entitled to do so even if this would not be in the general interest. If human rights are created by majorities, of what use are they? Their value lies in that they can be used to insist that majorities honor the dignity of minorities and individuals despite their conception of their greater good. Rights cannot be created. They must be discovered or they are of no value. As Dworkin concludes, if we want to defend individual rights, we must try to discover something beyond utility that argues for these rights. What could that something be? Neither Dworkin nor Dershowitz can really give an answer. Dworkin ends up appealing to a form of majority rule anyway. In Life's Dominion, an argument about abortion, euthanasia, and individual freedom, Dworkin writes, "The life of a single human organism commands respect and protection because of our wonder at the processes that produce new lives from old ones. The nerve of the sacred lies in the value we attach to a process or enterprise or project rather than to its results considered independently from how they were produced." Law professor Michael J. Perry responds this way. He writes, "The non-religious source of normativity for Dworkin is the great value we attach to every human being, understood as a creative masterpiece. It is our wonder at the processes that produce new lives from the old ones." But to whom is Dworkin referring with his we and our? Did the Nazis value the Jews intrinsically? The conspicuous problem with Dworkin's secular argument for rights is that Dworkin assumes a consensus among human agents that does not exist and never has existed. Perry's new book, Toward a Theory of Human Rights, is very significant. Though he himself makes no claim personally to strong religious faith, Perry writes, "Though it is clear there is a religious ground for the morality of human rights, it is far from clear that there is a non-religious ground, a secular ground for human rights." Perry lays out Nietzsche's well-known insistence that if God is dead, any and all morality of love and human rights is baseless. If there is no God, argues Nietzsche, Sartre, and others, there can be no good reason to be kind, to be loving, or to work for peace. Perry quotes Philippa Foot, who writes that secular thinkers accepted the idea that there is no God and no given meaning to human life, but, she writes, they have not really joined battle with Nietzsche about morality. By and large, we have just gone on taking moral judgments for granted as if nothing had happened. Why do we keep on doing this? The reason is laid out in a classic essay by late Yale law professor Arthur Leff. Most people feel that human rights are not created by us, but are found by us, that they are there and must be honored by majorities, whether we like them or not. But, Leff writes, when would it be impermissible to make the formal intellectual equivalent of what is known in barrooms and schoolyards as the grand says who? In the absence of God, each ethical and legal system will be differentiated by the answer it chooses to give to one key question. Who among us ought to be able to declare law that ought to be obeyed? Stated that baldly, the question is so intellectually unsettling that one would expect to find a noticeable number of legal and ethical thinkers trying not to come to grips with it. Either God exists or he does not, but if he does not, nothing and no one else can take his place. If there is no God, then there is no way to say any one action is moral and another immoral, but only, I like this. If that is the case, who gets the right to put their subjective, arbitrary moral feelings into law? You may say the majority has the right to make the law, but do you mean that then the majority has the right to vote to exterminate a minority? If you say no, that is wrong, then you are back to square one. Who says that the majority has a moral obligation not to kill the minority? Why should your moral convictions be obligatory for those in opposition? Why should your view prevail over the will of the majority? The fact is, says Leff, if there is no God, then all moral statements are arbitrary, all moral valuations are subjective and internal, and there can be no external moral standard by which a person's feelings and values are judged. Yet Leff ends his intellectual essay in a most shocking way. He writes, as things are now, everything is up for grabs. Nevertheless, napalming babies is bad, starving the poor is wicked, buying and selling each other is depraved. There is such a thing as evil. Altogether now, says who? God help us. Leff is not simply concluding that there is no basis for human rights without God. He is also pointing out, as are Dershowitz and Dworkin in their own way, that despite the fact we can't justify or ground human rights in a world without God, we still know they exist. Leff is not speaking generically, but personally. Without God, he can't justify moral obligation, and yet he can't not know it exists. I have not tried to prove the existence of God to you. My goal has been to show that you already know God is there. To some degree, I have been treating the non-existence of God as an intellectual problem, but it is much more than that. It not only makes all moral choices meaningless, but it makes all life meaningless too. The playwright Arthur Miller reveals this vividly through the character Quentin in After the Fall. Quentin says, "For many years I looked at life like a case at law. It was a series of proofs. When you're young, you prove how brave you are or smart. Then, what a good lover. Then, a good father. Finally, how wise or powerful or whatever. But underlying it all, I see now, there was a presumption that one moved on an upward path toward some elevation where God knows what, I would be justified or even condemned, a verdict, anyway. I think now that my disaster really began when I looked up one day and the bench was empty. No judge in sight. And all that remained was the endless argument with oneself, this pointless litigation of existence before an empty bench, which, of course, is another way of saying despair." What is he saying? We all live as if it is better to seek peace instead of war, to tell the truth instead of lying, to care and nurture rather than destroy. We believe that these choices are not pointless, that it matters which way we choose to live. Yet if the cosmic bench is truly empty, then who says that one choice is better than the others? We can argue about it, but it's just pointless arguing, endless litigation. If the bench is truly empty, then the whole span of human civilization, even if it lasts a few million years, will just be an infinitesimally brief spark in relation to the oceans of dead time that preceded it and will follow it. There will be no one around to remember any of it. Whether we are loving or cruel in the end would make no difference at all. Once we realize the situation, there are two options. One is that we can simply refuse to think out the implications of all this. We can hold on to our intellectual belief in an empty bench and yet live as if our choices are meaningful, and as if there is a difference between love and cruelty. Why would we do that? A cynic might say that this is a way of having one's cake and eating it too. That is, you get the benefit